Well, good afternoon again, brethren. I get situated here. Just another quick housekeeping announcement. Just a way of reminder, if you didn't see, Mrs. Penrod's obituary was in the Albany paper this week, and we have a copy on the bulletin board as well, if you'd like to take a look at it and read it. So it's up there for our perusal and to read about her life. And it's always interesting how you learn so much about somebody sometimes from an obituary where you don't learn it just actually talking to them face to face. Thank you for that lovely special music. It was nice, and I thank the youth choir for all their hard work and practice and being able to stand up there and sing for us. So thank you very much. Well, today, brethren, it's good to see you, and it's been a pleasure to be here, and it's been a pleasure to enjoy our summer months. It's going to be gone before we know it. Before we know it, we'll be cursing the liquid sunshine that will be coming down, wondering when the hot weather will come again, lamenting the days that have gone past. So enjoy it while you can. In fact, this nice weather recently inspired my family and I to go backpacking. It was the inaugural trip of the Kester family with kids backpacking trip. We decided, you know what, in an effort to be a more responsible parent, person, and man, I decided to look at my calendar, and I have one of those big desk calendars, and I flipped it open, and I put everything that's going on in the summer, and I cried. And then after I was done crying, I decided to look at it, and I said, okay, well, which weekends do I have free? Because if I don't fill them in now, they will get filled, whether I like it or not, with something I want to do or not, whether it's laziness or whether it's activity. So I said, I want to spend at least one weekend a month doing something fun with my family. And in this kind of this the snowball effect of this going. So we said, all right, this weekend is reserved for backpacking. We're going. All right? So irregardless of what else is going on in the world, we have reserved this weekend for backpacking. So we start. And I remember as a kid, my parents always staying up till like 3 in the morning the night before, every time we went camping or anywhere. And I said, why did they do that? Well, it's obvious. I know now why. So here we are. We've decided. We spent a good many hours finding the place to go. I called the ranger station in Detroit and said, you know, we'd like to go to Duffy Lake. We'd like to go to this place. And he said, well, there's lots of bugs there, and the mosquitoes are pretty voracious. I don't think I want to go there. And, maybe someplace else. So we, dug around. And we found this place in Mount Jefferson Wilderness area, which you're looking at there. It's just beyond. So if you're driving to Atta Sisters, coming back to Salem on Highway 20, Mount Washington is there. We're on the other side of Mount Washington, south. So we couldn't see each other because of a mountain. And so we got everything together. We got it all wrapped up. And, trips are stressful. Add living in the wilderness for 2 days to it to just amplify that stress. Are we going to have enough food? I don't know. 50 pounds isn't quite enough. We need a little bit more. Maybe some more toilet paper. Maybe some more of this. And everybody's frantically trying to get ready to go. We get there. We have all of our permits. There's quite a few. We're ready. We get out of the car and immediately are assaulted by millions and millions of mosquitoes. It's like, oh, what did we get ourselves into? This is the high arid desert. No, it's like a swampland. Bloodsuckers everywhere. And my wife had thought ahead and bought every one of us mosquito nets. I had never worn them before in my life, but I was very grateful for them. So as you can see, this other picture of us enjoying dinner, cooking on a stick, wearing mosquito nets. So for 2 miles, not a very far hike, we're slugging through it, kind of like, wonder what it's going to be like. So, it's not too cold, not too hot, it's perfect temperature, but the bugs are everywhere. And every time you wanted to take a drink, you'd be like, lift the net, stick the water bottle in, sort really fast, close it back down, make sure you didn't get bugged. And I'm sure it's a really, really pretty area. If there was at least a copious amounts of DDT applied to the entire wilderness, it'd be great. But at this exact moment, it was the bug hatch, and it was miserable. So I'm thinking, we've driven all this way, we're hiking all this way, what's it going to be like? I'm not sure. And we finally get to the lake, and it's pretty, it's going to be fun, this is the outdoor kind of Carl I like. This is adventure. Get to play around a little bit. And we settle in for the night. We cook our dinner, have a nice campfire. As you can see, it's there. We've got sticks roasting, or hot dogs. And, we're able to manage through it, just like drinking water, a duck and cover exercise, you know. Open, eat, duck, cover, spray some insecticide on your side, rub it around, and just pray you don't get eaten. And, you know, we survived the first night. Next day is the Sabbath. We hiked in on a Friday. Next day is the Sabbath, and we're standing around, and it's like, you know, I don't know if you're anything like me. You never sleep well the first night, camping, hiking, anything. And you're just kind of awkward, a little bit sore, didn't know you had those muscles, and then you're laying there wondering what's going on, listening to the symphony of bugs outside your tent, and thinking, oh, okay, what's going to happen? So, you know, and then you're groggy, you get up the next morning because you're in a tent and there is no real light protection, so it's early. You get up, make a fire, and get everything kind of going, and it's kind of, you know, that smudgy fire stage, smoke's coming off, and kind of hovering over it, hoping for bug protection. And then all of a sudden, I'm waiting, thinking how I'm going to make my cup of coffee. And, you know, we'd prepared in advance, so Sabrina had diligently got out and picked the woods, and we had this nice big pile of firewood ready to sit there and feed the fire, hoping it would keep the bugs away all day. And thinking about where this coffee would come from, what we're going to do for Sabbath. And all of a sudden, four people in uniform show up. Green and light khaki uniforms. And I was thinking, huh, well, this will be interesting. Wonder why they're here. And they asked us how we were doing. Did we have our wilderness permit? And then they started to ask us some other questions, some pointed questions that I didn't appreciate so much. Sort of like, well, is that your fire ring? At least that's what I heard in my mind. Like, is this your fire pit? Is this your camp? Yes, is this your stuff? And saying, yes, 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 it's all. Where are we going? What's going on? Did you know you have to be 100 feet away from water? Well, it looks pretty far from water. Looks like it'll be okay. I mean, what's wrong? It was already here. We're just using an established site. We're doing what the rules say. Oh, and then they started to talk about wilderness ethics. And I was thinking, I don't need a sermon. Just tell me what you want to do. And I was getting angrier, trying to keep this facade of pleasantness, and thinking, come on, it's early in the morning. I just want my coffee. I just want to camp. Leave me alone. And we're going through this, and he's talking about the wilderness standards and how our campfire doesn't meet these wilderness standards and how we're not providing solitude for people who want to come out to the wilderness and how our campfire is too close to the water. And, you know, if you were to take a tangent over there, it would be close, but it might make it over there. And I was done. And he started talking about all of these things. And I was just thinking, don't you realize what I was doing? I was minding my own business, camping in a perfectly pretty place, bothering no one. Just leave me alone. That's all rolling through my brain as I'm trying to be helpful. And okay, we'll get fire, we'll get water, we'll help put it out. And then he starts describing in lecture style, continuing on. He's like, well, you know, I've been doing this for many years, and I learned this stuff back in college. And I'm thinking, you had to learn this in college? Come on. Give me a break. Give me a break. We put the fire out. We put so much water on that fire that when we left Sunday morning at around 11 o'clock, it was still wet. Then they proceeded to take all the little rocks that had been put there by careful other campers and spread them throughout the wilderness so we might have the intuition or tenacity to go get them back. They spread them far and wide. And then they were getting ready to spread the firewood far and wide because they didn't want it to be picked clean. And I was just, oh, gotta be kidding me. So later that day, I was laying in the tent because there wasn't much more to do. And listening to the bugs, licking my bruised ego. And I kept thinking, well, are you sure it's 100 feet? I've got 100 feet of paracord. I could walk out there and nail it down and make sure. I mean, come on. What a jerk. I had to admit, I was both angry and humiliated. I had to admit that my pride, my sense of self-worth as a person capable of not starting a forest fire and able to gauge 100 feet was being called into question, and I didn't really appreciate it. I don't like being told what to do. especially at 8 in the morning when coffee hasn't arrived yet, and I just want to have a campfire and be left alone by forest rangers and bugs. Well, maybe I had a problem with something called pride in that situation. Could be very easily what it was about. And pride is and can be a problem for all human beings, not just those who are stuck miserably camping, swatting bugs. And it's something as Christians that maybe we don't think about often enough. And I think that the sermonette ties in very nicely with what I want to talk today about. And that's pride. And I've been thinking about this lesson. It wasn't just this camping trip, but it's been lessons that have been on my mind since the days of Unleavened Bread. Because we want to think about those things that we learned during those days of Unleavened Bread and apply them to our lives as we go throughout the rest of the year. So today, I want to focus on pride. I want to focus on its development, what it leads to, and what attitudes it develops into. And then I want to focus on several areas where it can affect us as Christians and in our Christian walk. So why even talk about pride? Why even talk about it? That's for somebody else. That's not for me. That's an issue that the world has. That's not an issue I have. I think it's an area that we don't want to focus on, or we might feel it might not even apply to us. This is an emotion of the world. The world is filled with pride, conceit, and other negative aspects of pride. Turn with me to 2 Timothy 3. And today I will use some personal examples and some other things in that nature. The only thing I don't like about personal examples is they usually involve a person, namely me. But other than that, we'll try not to make it too much of an altar call and use those as an example to learn from. But as you're turning to 2 Timothy 3, keep in mind who this is talking about. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Times of stress, it says in the margin. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutals, despisers of what is good. Kind of describes what's going on today. But that's for them. That's for other people. That's not for me. I don't have that in my life. Nope. Me and God, we're like this. No, nothing would separate us. However, we are in the world, and I do think those attitudes can rub off on us. They can be something that we need to be careful of and watch out for and ensure that we're not described as in this list of proud, blasphemous, disobedient. In this list of perilous times, in perilous terms. So in light of this, I think pride is an interesting emotion because it can be positive, you know, pride in God's work, pride in God's way of life. But it can also be negative, and most often it is negative. And today we're going to focus on the negative aspect, the aspect of pride that's going to keep us from the kingdom. And according to Merriam-Webster's, pride is the following as the quality or state of being proud, such as an inordinate self-esteem, conceit, you might add in other synonyms, arrogant, a braggart, things like that. And then it goes on to talk about some of the positive aspects, and then it says, you know, a reasonable or justifiable self-respect, delight or elation arising from some act, possession or relationship, parental pride, etc. But we're going to focus on that first one, inordinate self-esteem, conceit. And the way I like to think about this is pride, proud. This is Carl Kester. According to the dictionary of Carl Kester, it's not unabridged. In fact, it's not very big. But pride, proud, the manifestation or very, there's not many words in it, manifestation or act of self-confidence, worth, or possession, whether in levels, appropriate or not, but as demonstrated by the individual. A way of saying it might be proud is the way you interact, or pride is the way you interact with others, your stuff, and your position. The way you interact with others, your stuff, or your position and what your relationship to it is. And as we're looking to these things, and you're looking up on the screen, the things that pride can prevent, it can prevent joy, gratitude, grace. It prevents humility, having a true sense of humility. It prevents submission, true godly submission to each other and to God. And it can hinder, if we're not careful, our relationship with God. Now, as you look at this negative aspect which pride can lead to, you might be asking, well, how is it going to lead to those negative relationships or to those negative aspects? How can it? What might be an example of this? And so I thought of an example that I think, you know, it doesn't sound too far-fetched. It's made up, but it could be a way that, you know, you look at this anger, impatience, schisms, strained relationships, a hard heart, distance from God. You can add and build to that list as long as well. You know, you think about, if I really have pride, what does that prevent? What does that prevent me from doing? Does it prevent, as mentioned in the sermon, forgiveness? Prevent those relationships from developing that we want to develop? Does it prevent my interaction with people who are outside the church, in the world, that we want to interact with them on a godly level, but proud, and our pride can sometimes maybe make a barrier there? So let's say you buy a new car. Let's say it's a nice, vintage, 1970s wood paneling, faux leather seats Pinto. It's nice. It's a smoking hot car. It's got the hatchback. It's a child herder written all over it. And it's nice. It's got that, you know, fuzzy seats and or that fuzzy floor and everything. And it hasn't been destroyed in a fire yet. And you're pretty, pretty stoked about it. It's shiny. You've waxed it. And you say to your best friend, look at that car. Look at this car. Ain't it a beaut? And maybe they say, well, yeah, you're right, it's something. It's a car. Not that great of a car. No, nobody claims about Pintos. Yeah, nice car, maybe. Well, and they walk around. Maybe they kick the tires a couple times, and they notice the bald spots. And why'd you put rims on a Pinto? That's kind of stupid. Yeah. You know, I've never really liked Pintos anyway. I think they're ugly and... it's just a death trap. Well, you might be disappointed. You might be disappointed that your pride and ownership has been sort of, well, deflated by your friend. And you might be a little angry, like, couldn't you just be happy I got a car? I mean, come on. I got a brand new car. You know I've always wanted a Pinto. Shut up and like it. Well, and you might just fester, like, why didn't they like my car? You know, it was a cool color, and the wood paneling, I really like that. And they had to scrutinize the tires. And as they continue to walk around it and maybe look at more things, maybe you start to get a little impatient, like, just leave the car alone. Just walk away. I don't need your input anymore. I don't need your validation. And then they start to scrutinize more, and then, you know, before that, before they leave, and before you even have parted ways that day, the relationship already has a little bit of a strain. Every time, you know, like, well, every time I'm going to show up in my car anymore, they're going to say, I hate Pintos. It's amazing you're still living. It's amazing it's not a death trap. And then it's strained, and it becomes more strained, and maybe you dwell on it a little bit. And, you know, then maybe you just don't want to forgive them. Maybe you just, that hard heart, just can't think about, just move to forgiveness. Can't say, I'm sorry, because we expect them to say, I'm sorry first. And so your heart becomes harder. And it leads to a distance with them, and it leads to a distance with God because of pride. So it's easy, in my mind, I mean, that's a, you might say, a pretty benign, but I could imagine something as idiotic as that happening. And you think about it. It doesn't take long before pride has triggered anger, impatience, and all these other secondary effects and distance us from the ultimate relationship we want to have, which is with God. So let's move into the meat of the sermon. The areas that we're going to focus on about pride. Their heart was lifted up. This is a phrase used in the Bible to describe people who were in situations where pride got the best of them. You can be turning to 2 Chronicles 26, and we're going to look at Uzziah and all the awesome things that Uzziah had going on for him. He was king. He did some pretty cool things, and it's the first time that I think in reading and studying this that I ever realized that there was an arms dealer in the Bible. So look at 26:16. All right, here, let me find. Oh, yes. In 26:15, we'll start. Well, we'll start in 11. Moreover, Uzziah had an army of fighting men who went out to war by companies according to the number of their on their roll, as prepared by Jael, the scribe, and Messiah the officer, under the hand of Hananiah, one of the king's captains. The total number of chief officers of the mighty men of valor was 2,600, and under their hand was an army of 307,500 that made war with the mighty men to help the king against his enemy. Hey, he's sitting high. He's got a big army. He's got big officers. He's got all this stuff. Then Uzziah prepared for them, for the entire army, shields, spears, helmets, body armor, bows and slings to cast stones. He's got quite a bit of military might going on. He says, and he made devices in Jerusalem, invented by skillful men, to be on the towers and on the corners to shoot arrows and large stones. So his fame spread far and wide, and he was marvelously helped till he became strong. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up. His heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Lord his God by entering the temple of the God, by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. His heart was lifted up. He looked at his military power, he looked at his military might and prowess, and said, "Look at me. Look what I've got going. I'm king. I can do what I want. This is the way we're going to roll it. We're going to run with it, folks." And in that, he did something very arrogant. Very arrogant. And he went to the temple and he burnt incense before the Lord. And the priest said, "Hey, Uzziah, that's not for you to do. That's not your job. Get out. Leave." What happened? Well, remember back in the previous slide? Anger, other these secondary emotions that can come with pride. In verse 19, then Uzziah became furious, and he had a censer in his hand to burn incense. And while he was angry with the priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead. While he was angry, why was he angry? Because he was being told not to do something. He was proud. He was there to operate and to offer incense. And you'll notice this the people that I have on this list here, Uzziah, Hezekiah, Nebuchadnezzar, Satan, they're all rulers. They're all people in high positions. They were all proud of the circumstances that they found themselves in. Their ability, their position, their gift, their talent, their image had gone to their head. What about us, brethren? Now let's look to Hezekiah. Hezekiah had great success. He too was a great leader in Judah. He had a miracle. God extended his life by 15 years. Remember that? But what does it say about Hezekiah? Turn over a couple pages, if you would. In Hezekiah 32:25, says, in those days, speaking of the sickness that Hezekiah had, in verse 24, Hezekiah was sick and near death, and he prayed to the Lord, and he spoke to him and gave him a sign. Remember the sign that he was given? But Hezekiah did what? Humbly submit to God and show gratitude? No, it says, did not repay according to the favor shown him, for his heart was lifted up. Therefore, wrath was looming over him and over Judah and Jerusalem. Because of his pride, there was, what does it say? Wrath. God's wrath was looming over him and his nation. But it says, we'll come back to verse 26 as we look into how this applies to us. He didn't go back to God with thankfulness, with a heart of gratitude, which is one of the things that would be prevented by pride and a relationship. As we go back and we look at that first, you know, joy, gratitude, grace, those things that are prevented by pride. He didn't have that. His heart was lifted up. We go to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar 5, not Nebuchadnezzar, there is no book. If you can find it, I'll be impressed. It's Daniel 5:20. And I've always liked the timing of this one. I don't know why. Maybe because it's not me, and it's easier to find satisfaction in, you know, ironic timing in other people's lives than your own. Oh, that's in verse chapter 7, sorry. And in verse 19 it says, "And because of the majesty that he gave him, all his peoples and nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down." That sounds like he's pretty much in charge. "But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride." Go back to that list. Where does it lead to? A hard heart. So, when his spirit was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened up, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was disposed from the kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And what happened? He was driven like an animal, driven from his kingdom, driven out. For 7 years, he had to suffer the punishment of arrogance. And I like the timing. It says, "And those words had left his very mouth." As soon as that thought was uttered about how great I am, his reason was taken from him, and he was shunned from his kingdom. You might think about, so Uzziah, his position, his military, all of these things led to his pride. Hezekiah, his successes, the way his kingdom was going, leading to his pride as well. Nebuchadnezzar, he was in charge of it all. He was the head of gold, leading to that arrogance and pride. And Satan, lastly on this list, in 28:17, you can read how Satan, it says in Isaiah as a parallel account, Isaiah 14:12, it talks about, "I will be like the Most High. I will be, and I will have my throne on the king of the north, the side of the north." In fact, I'll just read it since I can't remember it. Says verse 12, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut to the ground, you who weaken the nations. You have said in your heart, 'I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God.'" He had to believe he could do it. It'd be a fool's errand otherwise. Why? Pride had deceived him into such a way that he thought that this was actually something that was achievable. He says, "I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." It's pretty arrogant to tell God that you will be like him, you will be above him, and you will subjugate him. That's what he's saying. Ezekiel 28:17 describes more fully the attitude here. And I'm going to start in verse 15. It says, "You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created." Something that was perfect. Perfection. Beauty. "Till iniquity was found in you, by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence from within. And you sinned. Therefore I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor." He allowed himself to be corrupted by his beauty, by his pride, by his attitude. You know, you might be thinking, well, what are some phrases that go along with this kind of attitude? Being a parent and a person well acquainted with small children, I've heard this phrase recently.
Well, I'm really good at that. Yeah, I'm like excellent at that.
Oh, okay. I can do that, you know. Have you ever done it before?
No, but I got it down pat.
Stuff like that. That's that kind of heart was lifted up. We can do anything.
I'm really great at Legos. Or
other phrases that might be in there. But how does this apply to us, brethren? How does it apply to you and I? Because that's really where the rubber meets the road. How does our heart get lifted up? What does it mean?
Well, I think, in essence, we have phrases like, I'm really good at that, and I excel at that, and look at how much I make, or what I do. And often, we sort of forget where it all comes from. We forget how it happened. Somehow we feel that we are the ones who have gotten this position, this glory, this ability. And sometimes maybe we neglect the fact that we might just have a natural aptitude because our parents do. It's described in 1 John as this. First John, in describing some of the circumstances or the attitudes that we must be aware of, that are in the world, that we don't want in our lives, that we don't want in the church, is this love. It says, do not love the world for the things in the world or the things in the world. For if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Remember, For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but of the world. So we have this attitude, this pride of life, that we have done this. Somehow, this is because of our status, our abilities. There's an interesting article that I won't read, but I encourage you to read, that brings more light to it in Barclay's Daily Study Bible. It's interesting. It adds a little more light to this and to this attitude that is being described here. And when we're in this condition of pride, oh, I know it's easy to say, it's not me. When I look in the mirror sometimes, oh, yeah, it's not me. It's easy. But there have been circumstances where I've had to question that and like be like, maybe that's not so true. We tend to forget who and where it all comes from. And I'll read this, just read it out loud, and I would encourage you to listen to what it says. And it says, and you shall remember the Lord your God. Why? Why does Deuteronomy 8:18 tell us to remember the Lord our God? It says, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant with you, with which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. It is God who gives us the power to get wealth, to have success. It is God who gives us those opportunities. And oftentimes, I think it's easy to allow our position, our job, our career, or some other thing to define us. And when that is taken away, it hurts us. It hurts our ego. It hurts our pride. Versus having that identity to being a child of God and something that cannot be taken away. Unless we give it up. Uzziah took his position as king to allow himself to do things that were not for him. Because of his pride, after all, you know, he's king. I can do it. Who's going to tell me what to do? Are you? And it's easy to be snared by the pride of life, or maybe even just the circumstances by which we find our life. If we're youthful, young, don't worry, you too will be old. Don't allow that to go to your head, that you're strong now, and that there is no need of anything, no help, because you have the physical strength. Well, it's okay. You too will be 40, staring at a middle-aged, balding white guy in the mirror. Time will come. Time comes to us all. Time happens. And pretty soon, just because we are young, says Proverbs tell us that it is the young man's pride is his strength. Well, that's fleeting. It's something that's going away. We will be old. And it says that aged, their strength is wisdom. And it's easy to look at younger people and say, they have no wisdom or experience. Well, don't worry. They'll learn. It happens. It just needs, it takes time. But it's easy to take an attitude of superiority and pride because we are where we are just by life's natural circumstances, living. So what can we do? What can we do? What can we do when we find ourselves or our heart has been lifted up? We can do what Hezekiah did. Turn back with me to 2 Chronicles 32. Second Chronicles 32 describes what Hezekiah did when he realized what he had done and the attitude with which he was living. And in 2 Chronicles 32, in verse 26, it says, "Then Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord did not come upon him in the days of Hezekiah." We too, when we find ourselves in this condition, must humble ourselves, ask God for forgiveness, ask Him to show us our sins, ask Him and diligently seek Him. How can we humble ourselves? We can humble ourselves with fasting. We can ask Him to show us our inward parts, show us the sins that we might have lurking that will keep us from a relationship with Him. And remember, brethren, God resists the proud. It doesn't mean that He passively ignores them. No, it's an active resistance. It says, and so pride can reflect and affect our relationship with God in various forms. But in this word, when it says in 1 Peter 5, I'll read it. 1 Peter 5, it says that God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And that word there, resist, means to oppose. And according to Thayer's, it can mean to be can be to range in battle against. That God is in battle against us and against the proud. He resists us and He becomes against us. And we do not want that. When our heart is lifted up, we do not want that so that our relationship with God is effective. We want a positive relationship with God. All right. Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do. Ain't nobody. Got that right. That, to me, surmises the attitude of our culture, the attitude of our times, and the attitude of myself while I was dealing with the Forest Service. You got to be kidding me. It's a fire. Pride is an attitude of rebellion. It's an attitude of stubbornness. And it can come out, and if we're not careful, it can keep us from properly submitting to God, to each other, as God would have us do. And we're going to parallel two people here. Two people and their pride and their or lack thereof and their submission. First, you can turn in your scriptures if you want to 1 Samuel 15. And I'm just going to relay the story if you want to follow along. Pride affecting our submission to God and to each other. So 1 Samuel 15. Saul is king. He's just been given a mission. He's been told, go destroy the Amalekites. Not just one, but all. Make sure that there's nothing left. Destroy it all, and then you will have succeeded. What happens? Well, what happens is that Saul doesn't listen. Saul doesn't listen at all. He kind of maybe thinks that he's done right. And he says, in verse 20, and Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me and have brought back Agag, the king of the Amalekites, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. He says, I have done what God said to do. Well, Hattie, kind of. Maybe he had destroyed the majority of the people. He had left the king alive, and he had kept the animals. Remember, everything was supposed to be destroyed. What did Samuel say? He said, you know, this had to be one of the more tense and awkward conversations. He said, but Samuel said, oh, okay. What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen that I hear? Huh. Oh, no, I didn't take that. Well, why is it in your car? I didn't take it.
He wasn't fully submitting to the will of God. What does Samuel say? Samuel says, "Be quiet and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night."
So Samuel said in verse 17, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel, and did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel?"
When he was little in his own eyes, when pride had not got the better of him, when he had decided, before he had decided to worship God in his own way and to obey God in his own way.
He was king. He was, rightfully so. But yet he let people talk him into doing what was wrong, as if he knew better. He knew how to worship God. "Well, God told me to do this, but I think that I can do it this way, and I can do it better. It'll accomplish more. It'll accomplish both a sacrifice, that'll be a really great sacrifice. It'll be really awesome. And we'll destroy the majority of the Amalekites. It's a win-win." But it's not what God said to do. Fundamentally, it's not what God said to do.
And he says, "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion, not doing what God has said, is the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness, not doing what God has said, as the iniquity and idolatry."
In this case, he let his pride, his heart, his ability to determine what was better, lead him astray.
Let's compare with Mary. Think about Mary in Luke 1, 30 through 39. You can write this down. What happens to Mary?
Mary is told, she's given a mission. She said, by the angel Gabriel, "You will have a son." She asks some interesting questions, like, how is this going to happen? I'm not even married. You know, there's some logistical issues that need to occur here. And they go through those and they talk. And Mary's response is very interesting. It's very different. Very different than Saul's. Because Saul's was, "I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it my way, my own way." And Mary's was, "As your will, I will do it. I am the maidservant of the Lord. I will go there." And I think it's a remarkable story, especially for a young woman in what I would consider perilous times, to be pregnant, not married, and all of this stuff. And she completely follows God and submits to his will.
She said, "Behold, the maidservant of the Lord." I think that that's, I don't know, I just think that's remarkable to have that be your response upon when something, a difficult and a challenging task has come your way.
The next two items are issues that we've been dealing with since the church began. You might think of Philippians 4:3, where the Apostle Paul talks about two households who are fighting or disagreeing. And this attitude that can be behind it is, "Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do. I'm going to do it my way, the highway." And this is where coffee pots and Christianity collide. Oftentimes, and I'm not picking on the snack crew, but it's easy to have those things that are secondary issues collide. And if we're not careful, we can all be scalded. And it creeps into the church in the attitude, or in our lives, in the attitude of, "It's my way," or, "You can find something else to do." I've had that attitude, and it's not a good attitude to have. It could be our personal style and the way we do things that can be a barrier to others. And if we're not careful, it goes back to, "My way is the best way. That's okay that you have a way too. It's just not the best way." Sort of, and I've noticed that my style can be a little bit of sort of shoot first, ask questions later. Get it done, let's just move on, and we'll all be okay. Well, that can really scald some people if we're not careful. And it can be proud, it can be arrogant. And, or you could be like me and just don't like to do what you're told sometimes. It takes a little bit of, "Yeah, okay, I'll do it. All right, I can do this." And remember that planning the annual wombat rescue operation has not ever become a matter of life and death. Don't worry about it. Some things aren't that important. We can move on. We can cooperate. And, I mean, this is corrective to myself. Because remember that at the center of that attitude can be a big, nasty ball of pride. Just recently, I've been thinking about this more and more as I've thought about this topic and the lessons learned throughout the Days of Unleavened Bread, that I can't always take collaboration personally. Sometimes there is collaboration. There's things that are going to happen. I mean, just recently at work, I was thinking, I laid out this perfectly logical case of why you want to do something. Space, fact, financial, flexibility, everything's there. And yet, I think the client would probably do the exact opposite. And I was thinking, you don't need me. This isn't a collaborative process. You need just somebody to draw what you want to do. My input's not valid here. We can't take collaboration personally. We want to understand where the person is coming from. What is going on? So what does this mean for us when we think about submission, we think about cooperation, coordination in the church, and things like that? Well, as I was thinking about things that apply to us, I was thinking about, well, in the example of Saul, the people told him that it would be really great to have a sacrifice. They would kill the Amalekites and they would have a sacrifice, a really big one. And it would be great. And I would come back and say, as to us, brethren, as we look at the world and they say, this is a really great way to worship God, this is what we should do. We can say, no, thank you, and move on. Because just because somebody says this is how we worship God, we cannot be arrogant enough to presume that that's how God wants to be obeyed. We can't presume that God somehow magically changed his mind to Sunday. God says he wants to be worshiped on the Sabbath. Sometimes submitting to God may not be pleasant, and it may bring some unwanted consequences, like being a teenage girl in the time of Christ, pregnant, and maybe never having that veil lifted. If you think about the time when Christ, when he was there, and it says we weren't born to fornication, meaning they knew, they could do math and all of that. So it may mean that we submit to God, and it may not be pleasant. And I think about this in my own personal life, that we must not allow our ideas or our way of doing things to damage our relationships with our brothers and sisters in Christ. I have to be able to do things in a cooperative way and not take collaboration personally. Philippians 2:2. I don't know. Philippians 2:2. We have the antidote. It says, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. In verse 3, let nothing be done through ambition, selfish ambition, or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each of you esteem others better than themselves. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. The mind of self-sacrifice, the mind that says, I'm going to go and I am willing to sacrifice myself. And as I thought about this, I have to realize what is important, what is just life, what is just style and background, and what just doesn't really matter. And sometimes it's like Caleb said, or Mr. Janice said, we have to sit back and look at things. Sit back and think, analyze how things are going. And it is important for us to analyze how our actions affect others. Is there room for improvement in my life? Or am I causing others to stumble? Pride is blinding. It blinds us from seeing what we need to see. So here, we're going to run two parallel accounts. And I think, brethren, I'm sorry, we're probably going to go the full hour today. I'm going to get some frowny faces, I realize, but we're going to go the full hour. Pride is blinding. And I think these are two interesting scriptures because they're in completely separate parts of the Bible, but I like the parallel account and the parallel nature of them as it lists things that it describes as evil or abominable characteristics. In Revelation 3:17, it is the church to Laodicea, and it's talking about the church. And it says, you know what? You guys are a mess. You're a wreck. Look at what conditions are going on in there. And he lists out all these spiritual conditions. They have it physically well off. They need nobody. Right? Says, you have need of nothing. And I think how aptly that describes our society today. We need nothing. I can turn on the faucet, water comes out. I can walk to the store if I'm hungry. I can go to Burger King. I can go to the doctors. You know, and it says, "And to the angel of the church of Laodicea write, these things say the Amen, the faithful and the true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish you were hot or cold, or cold or hot." And then he says in verse 17, "Because you say, I am rich, I have become wealthy, and have need of nothing. And do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked." Is he talking physically, or is he talking spiritually? He's talking spiritually. They are spiritually wretched, spiritually miserable, poor, blind, and naked. And you look at the top, and if you look at what attitude is he combating, he's saying, "Because you say, I am rich and have need of nothing," he's combating that attitude of pride. Turn back with me to Ezekiel. They both talk about a condition of spiritual sickness. Here, God is describing his bride. He's describing the nation of Israel. And he says in verse 21, "That you have slain my children and offered them up by causing them to pass through the fire. And in all your abominations and acts of harlotry, you did not remember the days of your youth when you were naked and bare, struggling in your blood. You didn't remember where you came from, what happened, and what condition I found you in." That spiritual condition of pride is blinding. It prevents us from seeing who we are and what we were. In both of these cases, they didn't see how they were, the spiritual condition that they found themselves. They were spiritually unclothed. There was no garment of righteousness. They were both proud of the that wickedness was going on, and they were blinded to the real condition. It is a condition of the heart, brethren. A condition of the heart. So how about us? How does this all work for us now? Because that's where the rubber meets the road. It says, and I would say, well, we have to take an honest look at our spiritual lives. Not just during Passover, not just during the days of unleavened bread, but year round. Be looking at our lives, analyzing them. We have to ask God and be willing to ask and to be willing to look for God's eye salve, to ask him to help us to see, to help us to dig in and to look at the condition we find ourselves in. We must not allow pride to blind us into the two conditions of, I'm better than them. Man, you know, they got some problems, but I don't have those, so I'm naturally better than that. And the other one of the health and wealth doctrine. I'm doing great physically, so therefore I must be doing great spiritually. Right? Job, how many thousands of camels did he have and servants and other things? And God was working with him and showing him. In tandem with that, we have pride is deceptive. So we have blindness and we have deception. We're still talking about this matter of the heart. This condition of where our heart is lifted up against, is lifted up. And blindness being the condition of I fail to see altogether, and deception in that I fail to see correctly. There's a big difference. Blindness is easy, you just don't see. Deception is that you see the wrong thing, or you see incorrectly. Jeremiah 17:9 tells us what? Tells us that our heart is deceitful above all things, above all else. It doesn't say that, you know, maybe something else or sugarcoat it anyway. It says the heart is desperately wicked. And it's easy to say that it won't happen to me, that it's not me, that, you know, pride doesn't deceive me. I'm not doing anything wrong. I can think of all the mental gymnastics I've done at times in my life, where I've been deceived by my own arrogance. This deception also comes in too, where we tend to analyze the motivation of others. Think about the Pharisees. They were filled with pride. They were lifted up, and they analyzed the motivation of others. Oh, they must be wicked because these things are happening or these things are going on. They were deceived. They were deceived in their sense of self-worth and position. Think about Peter's response to Jesus on the night of the crucifixion. That's in Luke 22:30. Think about what he says and how his pride had deceived him. He says, "I am ready to go with you, God. I am ready to die. I will be there with you." And Jesus says, "No, no, so. The rooster's not going to crow three times until you deceive me." But in his pride, he was right there, and he was deceived. Well, how does this apply to us? Well, we too can be deceived like Peter. I got this. I can do this. I got it all under control. I don't need the help of God or others, or I am all in. I have to be careful and ask God for guidance. And ask Him to show us where the trouble lies. I mean, even our own actions, and just in the physical aspects of pride being deceptive, it's easy to have the attitude of, I can do everything, I can do it all. Right? Oh, I got this, I can overload my schedule, I can do, oh yeah, oh, I can do that too. Yeah, you need help with that? Oh, I got that. And before you know it, you're so booked and so spent that you got nothing. You can't do any of it. Pride is deceptive in that it also makes us feel, like Mr. Janisich talked about in the sermonette, like we are right. Think about how many times we've been in an argument with our spouse and we're right, I'm just waiting for them to apologize. And it'll be much easier if they would just apologize and we can all be happy and move on. Think about that. And that deception that tells us that we are right no matter what. But, like the sermonette said, we need to follow that advice. Apologize. Be humble. Ask God for His direction and His guidance. As we conclude this sermon today, brethren, let us remember, it is God who gives us everything. He gives us life itself. He has created the jewel that we call earth and the privilege that we have to live upon it. It is God who gives us wealth, life itself, and it's easy, when we have success, to develop an overinflated sense of self-worth. But we must remember that it is truly God who gives us everything. So let us seek Him, ask for His humility in our lives. Let us have true submission to Him and to each other, and not allow pride and the pride of our way to ruin relationships in the church. We must ask God for sight. Ask Him to heal. Ask Him to show us and to remove blinders that may be there by spiritual pride. And let's ask Him to remove deception if we have it from our hearts. Let us seek Him. Let us ask for His humility and for His heart. And let us ask Him to guide us and to remove any pride that we may have.